Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What did Iran want to do? Iran wanted to draw a line in the sand to say, this is enough. You please, this is a sort of deterrence from Iran's side. Iran wanted to showcase its abilities with missiles and drones, and ballistic and cruise missiles and drones. And also, crucially, Iran did not want to spark off a regional war, because even though Iran is happy with this sort of proxy war that's been going on in the region, and we've spoken about this before, it doesn't want a war in the region, and a really good evidence of that is as the drones, as the missiles were on their way to Israel, IRGC put out a statement saying, as far as we are concerned, we consider this matter closed.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Behind the Lines, recorded on April the 16th, as the world watches to see Israel's response to the Iranian barrage of drones and missiles which targeted Israel over the weekend. The potential for this conflict to escalate to a full-blown war between Israel and Iran still remains unclear and certainly a major risk. However, there's a lot that we can learn from what's happened in the last few hours, and for that reason it was great to get to talk to Charlie Gammell, who is an Iran expert. He's a historian, he's travelled extensively in the region, and now works as a consultant and advisor. Here's Charlie.
My name is Charlie Gammell. I've spent the last, 15, 16 years working in and around Iran, variously as a historian, a consultant, and latterly as a diplomat on the UK's Iran desk, so advising UK government on policy towards Iran, both on the sort of nuclear side and also on Iran's role in the region, which feels very prescient today, given what we're looking at.
Yeah, so we're talking in a period of bewildering and fast-moving events, but we'll try to stay as up-to-date as possible. Obviously, on the 1st of April, Israel carried out a strike on a diplomatic premise in Damascus, an Iranian diplomatic premises, and certainly at least one very senior Iranian military figure, and probably more than that, were killed in that strike. And Iran made very clear that it was planning a retaliation. And indeed, that was sort of signposted over several days, to the point that it almost seemed that maybe they'd decided against doing it. But that finally happened with the rather large number of sort of drones and missiles being fired at Israel, almost none of which had any impact. So I guess the first question that's quite interesting to try and grapple with is, what do you think Iran was trying to do, and how successful do you think they were with their strike against Israel?
Yeah, so I think starting with the events on the 1st of April, I think it's important to realise whatever side of the conflict one's on here, striking another nation's diplomatic facility is, in international law, akin to striking that nation's sovereign territory. So even though this feels like it's part of the, I think there's been 18 IRGC senior commanders killed in the course of the war around the region. This was a huge escalation by Israel, this choice to strike a diplomatic facility. And I remember at the time I wrote something for a paper saying, part of this is a desire for Israel to wrestle back the narrative away from some of the difficulties that they've got in Gaza and difficult relations with America, to try and send out this message that actually Iran is the big danger in the region by provoking Iran into doing something. So I think that's a point to make, that this was a huge escalation and there was potentially some thinking behind it from within Tel Aviv. And then we moved to the huge response that Iran did after that attack. After Soleimani was killed, there was a lot of thinking that Iran was going to respond disproportionately and that it was going to strike American assets in the region. It didn't actually do anything. So there was a thinking that after the 1st of April that potentially Iran will not do anything immediately. But then increasingly it became clear through US and other countries' intelligence apparatuses that Iran was going to do something. What did Iran want to do? Iran wanted to draw a line in the sand to say, this is enough. You please. This is a sort of deterrence from Iran's side. Iran wanted to showcase its abilities with missiles and drones, and ballistic and cruise missiles and drones. And also, crucially, Iran did not want to spark off a regional war, because even though Iran is happy with this sort of proxy war that's been going on in the region, and we've spoken about this before, it doesn't want a war in the region. And a really good evidence of that is, as the drones, as the missiles were on their way to Israel, IRGC put out a statement saying, as far as we are concerned, we consider this matter closed. So I think Iran wanted to showcase its capabilities. Iran wanted to send a message, but Iran also wanted to sort of really stress this point that it doesn't want a regional conflict. Not that it's not prepared for a regional conflict, but that it doesn't want a regional conflict.
Yeah. And obviously the point you made there about striking a diplomatic premises, it again, you and I have both at different times worked in that world, and it's extremely unusual, to the point of perhaps being unprecedented, certainly in recent years. I mean, if Iran had retaliated by blowing up an Israeli embassy in another city, I think that the world would probably be even more more alarmed than they are by recent events.
Absolutely. And an interesting point on this was that Foreign Secretary Cameron was interviewed on Sky News a day after, and the reporter just said, what would the UK do if one of its diplomatic facilities in another country were hit? And Cameron sort of had to concede that, well, we would respond in a way that was proportionate to the attack that we'd received. So in many respects, in hindsight, it's not surprising that Iran chose to attack Israeli soil, but I think, as again to stress, that this was a calibrated attack. And I think part of the calibration from Iran, something that hasn't been talked about a lot, was that Iran knows that the US is bringing its sort of influence to bear on Israel to try and stop a further retaliation. So I think there's this sense that Israel feels in the region that it's got a free hit because Iran doesn't want a war and therefore it can do what it wants. I think to a degree, Iran takes comfort from the fact, if you can, that the Americans are really pressing the Israelis not to escalate any further.
Going back to your point about Iran wanting to show its capabilities, depending on where you stand, one might say, well, its capabilities look rather limited. As I mentioned, that I think the number of 300 drones and missiles were fired at Israel, and maybe 1% of them got through. I think there may have been one person injured, sadly, but basically almost no impact. So some people are suggesting that Iran deliberately having sort of signposted the attack and doing it in a certain way that made it easier for air defense to deal with. Was this, do you think that Iran have come out of this learning that they don't have the facilities to strike Israel, or is there a rather more complicated message being sent here?
I think, as is often the case with Iran, it's a slightly more complicated message. You know, the Iranian military planners will have learned a lot from the way in which Israel and its allies responded to that attack. I think, as someone's pointed out, the missiles used weren't Iran's fast-moving ballistic missiles, and they were given warning, so that gave people time to prepare for it. So I think the message is much more complex. I think if you look at how much it costs for Israel and its allies to defend itself from this barrage of, as you say, 300 missiles and drones, It was about $1 billion. And I think for Iran to launch this operation, it would have been roughly under a tenth of that for them to launch it. So even though this has been a highly successful, from Israel's perspective, I think very much in the short term, a successful demonstration of the robustness of its alliances in Europe, in America, and in the Arab world, as it were, from Arab governments. I think in the longer term, there are lots of people on social media from the Arab world saying, at last, Iran is standing up to Israel, because I think even though this is distracting us from what's going on in Gaza, 33,000 and above Palestinians have been killed and is ongoing attacks in the West Bank. So the narrative has short-term swung back behind Israel to say there is a common enemy in the Middle East, and that enemy is Iran. We've seen the true colours of Iran, but I have a feeling that will be a relatively short-lived holiday if the war in Gaza and the events in the West Bank continue as they are. So I would definitely say there's nuance in this, and both sides can claim a sort of a victory, which in essence is where you would want to be, because I think just as you've got Joe Biden saying to the Israelis, you need to take a win here and don't escalate it, you'd want a very similar thing happening within Tehran, from the sort of the doves to the hawks.
Yeah. So you mentioned that obviously the Iranians will have learned from the experience, but presumably they already know quite a lot about Israeli air defences, thanks to their very close links to both Hezbollah and Hamas.
Yeah, exactly. And this is all part of... Yeah, exactly. You're right. We think that this is the sort of unprecedented, this is the first Iranian attack on Israeli sovereign territory. Actually, as you know, thousands of missiles have been going south from Lebanon since October the 7th. The Houthis have a sort of, you know, they've got their own kind of aerial offensive capabilities. Likewise with Hamas. Hamas's attack on October the 7th, drones played a really important part in that. And Iran, obviously, its use of drones has been paramount throughout Ukraine. So absolutely, this is just one bit of data that Iran has. I think if there is a broader sort of tactical lesson, it's that if it is a conventional war, Israel is actually relatively well equipped to deal with this. And that only given what we saw, even though it was at huge cost, and it might test the patience of its allies in the region if they're called upon to defend Israel consistently. But I think this really sort of re-stresses the point that Iran's greatest weapon in the region is its proxies. And if Iran really wanted to inflict considerable damage on Israel, well, it's got Hezbollah, it's got Hamas, it's got the Houthis who can do what they're doing in the Red Sea. Iran also has an incredibly strong naval capability, which is working to build up. And what can they do there? You know, they could mine the Straits of Hormuz, which would again grind global shipping to a halt. And Iran has that market for its energy products overland into China, which is its kind of hedge. That's its sort of safety blanket. So, right. Absolutely, I think that's a really important point. You know, that both sides are learning about each other.
So how does Iran's internal situation affect their approach to this crisis?
Over the last couple of days, I think one of the things that's been striking about the way this has been received in Iran is that you've got two effective narratives being played out. You've got the regime and its acolytes saying that we should hit Israel hard, and it's a good thing to have done because this protects Iranian vital interests, and it shows this is the sort of Persian concept of Hefse Arberu, which is saving face. And you've got lots of sort of pronouncements about Israel or Silizadim, like we slapped Israel in the face and we should do it again, which really plays into Iran's sort of own narrative itself as this kind of great nationalist, this sort of great regional hegemon, and one whom it's beneath sort of taking attacks from Israel. And then I think on the other side, you have this very strong narrative within Iran, and there was graffiti on various walls in Tehran saying, "Israelis, please strike Khamenei's house." And I think that even though that's kind of that's graffiti, that is reflective of a broader frustration within the Islamic Republic at what it sees as the regime's slightly reckless prosecution of a regional war, which might make Iran less safe. And why do Iranians think that? You know, around 2018-19, when there were protests in Iran, one of the big chants during the rounds was, you know, "We don't care about Palestine, we care about Iran. And Palestine is your war, it's not our war. And sort of fix our problems first before you go to war with a country that's sort of, you know, a way away from us." And the Islamic Republic has suffered protests increasingly over the last, I don't know, 7-8 years. particularly 2 years ago with the death of Mahsa Amini and the huge protest that engulfed Iran in the aftermath of that lady's death. And even though a lot of sensible Iran analysts would have looked at that and said it's not really changed the calculus of the stability within Iran as far as the regime is concerned, they will not be unconcerned about the possibility of a war in Iran causing a number of bits of Iran turning in on the Islamic Republic. So I think Khamenei and the Supreme Leader's office and the IRGC are aware that a war that causes direct Israeli retaliation into Iran will not make them more popular at home. It's not like in the early 1980s when Saddam invaded and Iran united. There's a potential that this could exacerbate existing tensions in Iran along ethnic lines, but then also along kind of much more headline-grabbing socio-political lines.
And is there any degree to which the outside forces, and notably Israel, but others, perhaps America, are involved in trying to take advantage of those cleavages in Iranian society?
I think that's a high wire balancing act. I think any group in Iran that is seen to be receiving support from America or any other outside powers that is looking to destabilize the country will be discredited within broad sections of the Iranian population. So I think that potentially, but I hope that those powers over the last 5-6 years would have seen that regime change within countries where you've got ethnic and other cleavages doesn't always end well. You think of Libya, you think of Syria, you think of a lot of countries in the region and Iraq that have had huge fragmentation after internal sort of political upheaval. So if anyone is looking to take advantage of that, one would have to tread incredibly carefully because the potential to upset the regional apple cart is huge.
Yeah. So we've talked quite a lot about Iran. Let's talk a bit about Israel. There is some reporting of drone strikes against senior Hezbollah targets happening today. I don't know if you've seen that today, 16th of April.
Yeah, and again, these are part of the conversations that obviously Netanyahu has been having with his war cabinet. And I think that if there's part of those conversations that he had with the war cabinet in parallel to that, he's having conversations with the White House. And the White House is absolutely clear that please confine this conflict to your backyard and do not kind of expand it any further because there's only so far. I mean, we have this sort of, America's been saying we have an ironclad support for Israel, but I know that privately they're also stressing that we will not countenance any more kind of recklessness in the region, and allowing or permitting or turning a blind eye to Israel attacking Hezbollah commanders in the north, that is more palatable to America because that's a war that's already going on. Israel and Hezbollah have been lobbing thousands of rockets at each other since October the 7th and then obviously from before that. So that would be, I would put that in the same bracket as calling on lots of European and world powers to sanction the Iranian missile program. And if you can call that a positive step, I'm obviously not calling it a positive step, but in relative terms, I think it's better for the region that these kind of drone strikes against targeted Hezbollah commanders happen as opposed to anything more inflammatory against the Iranian state. Obviously, I'm not condemning that kind of stuff, but I think that is evidence potentially of America's influence. They're bringing their influence to bear on Israel to keep the conflict within the existing confines. And you know, looking at the call to sanction ballistic missile programs, that I think is a good sign because it's Israel saying they've obviously taken something on board for America and they're looking for kind of a diplomatic sanctions win against Iran, which won't really impact Iran's ability to produce ballistic missiles. I mean, that's gone on before and it'll go on again. The technology will continue to sort of refine itself. So that is an indication of America being able to bring its power to, or its influence to bear on Israel.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the fundamental sort of distinction is Israel striking, for example, in striking Hezbollah targets, it is not striking Iranian territory, whether that's diplomatic or actually on within the sort of land borders of Iran. I guess, though, one could say that all of this has actually been quite a good outing for Netanyahu. And if I just explain what I'm saying here, before the April 1st strike, The war in Gaza. You had, of course, the terrible strike against the aid workers, the World Kitchen aid workers. And much as, of course, compared to the loss of life on the Palestinian side, it was a tiny number. Undoubtedly, these things have a big impact. So Israel was rapidly losing the sort of consent that it had in American political circles. But effectively, by picking a fight directly with Iran, it's forced America back to supporting it, even to putting its planes in the sky. And of course, we Britain have done the same thing. So have we all been played here by Israel?
I think that was my initial take on the Damascus attack. This was a way to get America back in on their side by striking at a common enemy that looms larger in the American consciousness than maybe Hamas. I absolutely think that.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
That was part of the rationale from Netanyahu, given, as you say, around the same time the striking of the aid workers, and then obviously this ongoing tragedy in Gaza. So I definitely think that was part of the thinking. And if this is a win for Israel, it's a short-term win, because nothing really will sort of elide the tragedy that's going on in Gaza, and actually not just what's going on in Gaza, but the perception of this on the Arab street. And for Iran, this gives them more kudos on the Arab street. And so I think that even though this is striking back at Israel, gives them more kudos on the Arab street. So I think even though, yes, this is a short-term win for Israel, I think that it won't be long before the issue of Gaza comes back into people's minds. You know, put simply, who's going to rebuild Gaza? And you've even got former senior Shin Bet leaders saying, writing in Foreign Affairs, saying, the only way to take the oxygen out of the Hamas narrative that is so appealing to people in Gaza and to broader Muslims in the Arab world is for a two-state solution. You know, it's a bit like the logic that people use for the JCPOA on the Western side. If we cease to be the bad guys, then we're denying the hardliners in Tehran the oxygen of the narrative that says that we are the bad guys. Yeah. And I think that increasingly consensus will build that if someone has to rebuild Gaza, and someone has to administer Gaza, and then there has to be a two-state solution, because that's the only way that Israel can be safe. And I just think that once you've got people in this, people sort of former senior Shin Bet people in Israel saying this, hopefully that sense will prevail. Obviously, that the kind of black swan in all of this is potentially a Donald Trump White House, who may not see things in those terms, both on the kind of Israeli side, but also how they see Iran and what role they think Iran can play in the region.
Yeah, but I guess before we even get to a Donald Trump White House, you have the political crisis that is still there in Israel, which to some extent, you know, the moment the war ends, Netanyahu's status as prime minister looks very rocky. The two things are intimately linked now. And in a way, Netanyahu needs the war to continue. So therefore, for him, whilst, of course, he doesn't want a full-scale regional war with Iran or with anyone else, these kinds of escalations, such as the one against Damascus, are very much in his interests, aren't they?
Absolutely. And there's a fragility of his own coalition within Israel. I think you could extend that further and say, once the hostages have been returned, then what? Yeah. Then where's the logic for fighting? I think it's increasingly, it's becoming acknowledged that you're not going to defeat Hamas. But it's, as you say, it is in Netanyahu's interests to expand this, to create another bogeyman if the war in Gaza is going in the way it's going. And effectively, it might be winding down because Hamas are less able to fight back. I think you look at the statistics of the number of rockets that are going from or were going from Gaza into Israel. They have decreased rapidly or steadily over the time. You're right. He needs to carry on this war. Otherwise, his own, that's what his base depends upon. And I think finding a solution to the conflict that involves Netanyahu post that will be very difficult. And I think there is a danger that he could try and hold on through continuing to pick fights throughout the region where it's not necessary.
Yeah. You mentioned that the Arab Street, which is obviously, you know, it's a term of art. We're talking about popular opinion in the Arab world. And obviously in many countries of the Arab world, popular opinion is not expressed very easily. You know, we're talking about autocratic countries. One of the challenges that seems to present itself is Iran, and with through its proxies as well, particularly the Houthis, but others have managed to portray themselves as sort of heroically standing up for Palestinians. Whereas you have, for example, the Jordanian Air Force going out in defense of Israel. In fact, I've seen social media posts from sort of pro-Arab accounts depicting the leaders of Israel's neighbors, so Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, with wearing Israeli army uniforms. So it's obviously, you know, there's this idea that they've all become sort of puppets of Israel. I personally, just to be clear, I'm not saying I agree with that, but that's a meme, a social media meme. So it seems what one of the real difficulties here is for Saudi Arabia, which of course has the biggest economy, it has a huge population, it has this desire to try to regularize its relationship with Israel on economic basis. Where do these events leave that agenda?
I mean, I think that agenda has been on very shaky ground for a long time. The only potential win here is that the US can use Iran's retaliation as a way to strengthen the potential alliance between Arab states and Israel through the sort of pre-October the 7th narrative that, guys, the big problem in the region is the Iranians. So in some ways, Iran aggression strengthens that sort of pre-October the 7th narrative. And if you look at, I think a pre-October the 7th world was one in which Iran was becoming more isolated, less popular, because the issue of Israel-Palestine or the Palestinian issue was going sort of further down the kind of food chain, as it were.
Yeah.
But I think that Iran knows that there's a good deal of unpopularity within. I was talking to a friend in Saudi Arabia the other day, and he is shocked at how unpopular Israel is becoming. I mean, obviously Israel was always unpopular, but increasingly, and it's obviously, there's very good reasons why. The Arab states are interested in Israel because it's got a burgeoning tech environment, it's got weapons capabilities. This was a way for them. That was the get that they were going to get from that alliance, was that they were going to get access to the market, to a market of really advanced stuff that they would need to grow their economies and also to kind of increase their military capabilities. But I think that now with what's gone on, it's less palatable for them. You know, this isn't an ideological hedge from the Arab world to the Israelis. And you could dress it up as, look, the big enemy is the Iranians. But I think it makes it even more difficult for Arab nations to sell that to their populace after what's happened in Gaza. And I think if you're thinking with sort of big picture Western diplomats hat on, I think that getting Arab nations buy-in to pay for some of the reconstruction of Gaza is a way to bridge that gap. Now, obviously, you know, there's some very deep pockets in the region, but I think that would be a really good way for Israel and the Arab world to come together to rebuild somewhere. And as a sort of symbol of potential partnership and hope, I suppose, in a post-conflict Gaza, I think that would be a good diplomatic move to make. And America and other countries, the UK in particular, they have that clout diplomatically on both sides of the conflict. So with Arab nations and within Israel.
Yeah, I guess the challenge there is that those Arab nations are probably unlikely to want to do it if it's under the auspices of an Israeli military occupation.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I think this is where we go back to the two-state solution issue.
Yeah.
And I was speaking to someone very recently about this, saying the Middle East pre-October the 7th was on a path to potentially normalizing ties. And this was actually pre-October the 7th, I was speaking to him. And he said, but the Israel-Palestine issue is the one thing that could trip it all up. Mm. And that's where I think it just becomes incumbent on the US to use all its kind of diplomatic oomph. And there's receptive ears within Israel for this. Obviously, might be getting fewer now, but that absolutely has to be a cornerstone, because without it, where does this end? You know, Israel can't destroy Iran. Israel can't get rid of Hamas, because if it gets rid of Hamas, something else will come up instead. It can't. The only way it can sort of lessen the appeal and take the oxygen out of Hamas and all these groups that are fighting it is by coming to some kind of diplomatic solution to this, which respects both sides. And that's the only way I think this can be solved.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the logic of your position is undeniable. I guess the challenge we have is that even if you fix Gaza, which is, you know, that's a big even, it's quite hard to see how you can unwind the whole sort of settlements challenge in the West Bank. And then you're back to the fairly intractable debates around states of Jerusalem, you know, right of return, all the rest of it. But in a setting where the question particularly of West Bank settlements has become very violent, very fraught, highly charged, in much more than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Absolutely, and I don't think it's any coincidence that there's been more violence in the West Bank within the last couple of days.
Yeah.
That these, and I'm by the, and it might be I'm sort of talking in quite blithe, generalistic terms here, but and I'm not unaware of the scale of these challenges that are being faced. But I think, given the scale of the problem, one has to think big, commensurate to the size of the task that we're facing, and these are sort of really big, long-standing issues. But you've got so many other things in the region. You've got Khamenei, the Islamic Republic, the supreme leader there. What might follow him? Might it be more or less favourable to Israel? My sense is that it might not have the, it might not be as willing to draw back from conflict as Khamenei is. It might be a little bit more forward leaning when it comes to Israel. So there's lots of things going on in the region that are difficult to predict. So I think we have to always be aware that there's obviously lots of things that could go wrong in parallel to the solutions that we're talking about.
Yeah, and another element of this, which you know, the sort of the two-state solution and the long-term relationship between the Arab Gulf states and Israel is very much a sort of Western preoccupation. I mean, that's not to say that they're not things that have their own value. What about the burgeoning sort of peace, we might say, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which was sort of a Chinese initiative that, again, was slightly upended by the October 7th massacre?
I mean, I think this was an indication that and the context for that is very much part. It was very much America taking a step back from the region. And working through Saudi to say, and you know, Saudi Arabia took the very pragmatic decision: we don't have a huge standing army like the Americans do, and we're not going to police the Middle East, because that's not really what we want to do. You know, Mohammed bin Salman wants to grow the economy. He has these very specific domestic goals that he wants to achieve, and a big part of that was, to a degree, coming to some kind of rapprochement or relationship with the Iranians to say, well, you know, you guys look after Iraq. We'll look after the bits we want to look after, and we might be able to come to a solution on Yemen. That, again, that was a sign, that was a positive sign in the pre-October the 7th world that suggested that in the absence of America in the region, you might have regional powers looking to take it upon themselves to forge diplomatic alliances, which can be the things that govern how the region sort of deals with itself without going to war. And I'm, you know, speaking to people in Saudi Arabia, that's a very pragmatic step that bin Salman's taking. And I think that's a really positive one. And Iran's enmity with Saudi, I think it was an indication that it doesn't have to be that way. If they agree places where they're contested and they agree who's going to look after what, then I think you can come to some kind of arrangement. And obviously, as you say, October 7th has blown that out of the water.
Yeah.
And I think, sorry, Arthur, one point there. I think we look at the slightly more headline grabbing one was the potential Israeli-Saudi alliance. I think that there's more of a history within Saudi Arabia of rapprochement with Iran than there has necessarily been between, obviously, Saudi and Israel. There are little pockets of history over the last 30 years where the Iranians and the Saudis have looked to talk to each other, and it's been other events that have got in the way. So I think that sort of any post-Gaza world should, I think the Chinese should sort of bring their influence to bear there to get that thing back up and running again.
Yeah. So I guess finally, we've talked a bit about the powers in the region, and we've just touched there on China. But what about the US? Because you've got this situation where the patience between the Biden administration and Netanyahu was really running thin. There was a sense that there was even a question as to whether or not the Americans would continue to sort of facilitate Israel's ability to carry out its assault on Gaza. Yeah. All of that got paused in the last couple of weeks, basically, with this crisis over Iran. Are we going back there, or have Israel successfully reminded America, actually, you don't have a choice on this. You always have to support us.
So I think the Biden administration is facing the same challenges with Israel. I think prior to this exchange of attacks from Damascus and then into Israel, the Biden administration was trying to restrain Netanyahu and the IDF on the battlefield. I think now they are still trying to restrain them. Well, they are definitely still trying to restrain them, but in the region. So to some extent, that the challenge that the Biden administration is facing remains the same. And I think that it's a double-edged sword here because the Israelis have been saying to the Americans that, you know, you need us in this region because Iran poses a threat to all of us. But then the Americans have very easily, very quickly said back to the Israelis, actually, that works both ways. You need us to help you. You need us to defend you from this. And your own reckless actions are putting you at risk. And it's also potentially jeopardizing the alliance. I think the public support will be there, will always be there. And there's no doubt about that. But I don't think for one second that the wool has been pulled over President Biden's eyes about this. They are still absolutely crystal clear with Netanyahu that we have to bring the Gaza conflict, you know, to a close however we can, and also minimizing civilian casualties on the battlefield and then restraining yourself in the region. And I think that's been a clear message that the Biden administration has sent to Netanyahu about its potential response to Iran's the missile and drone attacks.
Yeah. Do you think this is a turning point for Israel itself? Because in a way, Israel's self-perception and its sort of face to the world has been that Israel stands alone, it defends itself, it doesn't rely on others. Now, someone might push back and say, look, they rely completely on America, both financing and arming them. But in the sort of operational sense, you know, it's the Israeli military doesn't find itself fighting alongside sort of allies from other countries. But, you know, that isn't what happened in the last few days.
No, absolutely. And I think I heard an Israeli commander on the news prior to Iran's attack. And obviously, given the context, didn't sound in a great way, did not sound very positive, was struggling to answer the questions. And then post the attack, were sort of relatively jubilant about the strength of the alliance, the military success of repelling this attack. So yes, I think it has changed. Israel does not see itself now as sort of standing alone in the region, but then that was part of its logic for doing what it did in Damascus. I think another point on perception is that I'm not saying that Israel won't necessarily respond directly to Iran. I think what I'm saying is that America is doing everything it can and Israel's allies are doing everything they can to prevent it from responding to Iran's attacks. I think the danger is perception of weakness and Israel looking at the Iranians' unwillingness for a conflict and misconstruing that as weakness. And I think that's a real perception miscalculation risk that Israel runs, and in this sort of fog of war saying, you know what, time is right now, we might not get a better chance than this to push back against the Iranians. So I think that is an extant risk, and it's on the Americans and on Israel's allies to persuade them against that course of action.
Yeah. Well, I think on that very important point, it just falls me to thank you for joining me today at short notice in this rather bewildering time, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you, Arthur. Yeah, look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. Behind the Lines was produced and presented by me, Arthur Snow.